You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 58, Acts 23 through 26. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. We got a lot of ground to cover today, Trey.
We do. We got, what, four chapters?
Yep. Acts 23 through 26. A lot of these chapters is just Paul's appearances before different people. He repeats again his testimony in places or parts of it. So I'm not going to really worry about any of that stuff. I want to get to the more interesting, again, biblical theological stuff that we run into along the way. So let's just jump in here with Acts 23. I'll begin reading at the beginning, and then we'll skip around periodically as we, we'll land some places too. So Acts 23. This is Paul speaking again to the Jewish leadership. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, 'God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet, contrary to the law, you order me to be struck?'" Let's just stop there for a moment. This might have strike some, no pun intended, but strike some people as a curiosity. You know, what exactly is Paul talking about here when he says, you know, "Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law you ordered me to be struck?" Apparently, what Paul has in mind and what Luke records here is a reference and a violation of Leviticus 19:15, which says, "Do no injustice in judgment. Do not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. With justice shall you judge your associates." So the idea would be that, again, Paul is, you know, he's, who is he? I mean, he's sort of a, I don't want to use, you know, victim here. This isn't like a biblical theology of victimhood here, but I mean, he's obviously at a disadvantageous position, and he knows that the law says that people brought before the Jewish judges, the elders, should be treated with impartiality. And so he takes offense at the high priest commanding that he be struck and interprets that act as being a violation of Leviticus 19:15. So that's probably the reference. The other thing, this is sort of under the current, Paul doesn't actually say this and there's no commentary, but that the high priest did this to have this prisoner struck, he could have been in big trouble there because Paul was a Roman citizen. Again, that's just something that sort of is a subcurrent there. But that, in fact, would have been the case. You know, as you weren't supposed to do this to Roman citizens, and so the Romans, if they had known about this, could have, you know, come down hard on the Sanhedrin or done something in retaliation. But anyway, let's just keep going. Those who stood by said, you know, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I didn't know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" So Paul very clearly wants, you know, to be consistent, wants to obey the Torah himself, but again, the point is still made. Verse 6, "Now when Paul perceived that one part of the group, of the council, were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council," this is a stroke of genius, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply, 'We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him?'" Of course, the Sadducees aren't going to want to hear that because of the things they don't believe. Verse 10, "And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him to the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, 'Take courage. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome.'" So we'll stop there at the end of verse 11. I want to camp a little bit on this scene where Paul divides the audience, again, detects by some means that we have Pharisees and Sadducees both in the room. So he pits them against one another, which is brilliant, by appealing against the resurrection. So in verse 8, we get this line, "For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all." Now, I actually got a question about this from someone who was watching my Logos Mobile Ed course on the Jewish Trinity. And I'm going to read that question for you, and then I'll read my answer because it directly relates to this. And what I'm going to read for you is actually taken from the companion website, the website that I created to go with my book, The Unseen Realm, again, which isn't quite out yet. But there's a lot of information on that website that has hooks into the content of the book. And this is one of those in case, one case in point. So what will be the web page for chapter 37, I believe, it will actually have what I'm going to read to you here. So here was the question. The questioner says, I've been watching Dr. Heiser's Mobile Ed 291 course on how the Old Testament reveals the Christian Godhead. I enjoy his teaching, but in one segment he makes a statement that I would like to ask him for some clarification. So here's the question. Here's what I say. I say in the video, let's take a look at this. We have some problems with it right away if we give it some thought. The same language is used to the heavenly beings of Yahweh or the angels like the Lord of hosts. I'm talking about, you know, Elohim and some other things in that segment. So we can't assume, obviously, that the host of heaven and phrases like that are not real because there's a populated spiritual world and all branches of Judaism and Christianity are going to believe that point. End of quote. So I'm saying, hey, you know, Jews basically, no matter what branch of Judaism, what little party they are, they're going to believe that there are angels, okay, and that they're real beings. So the questioner had Acts 23:8 in mind, and he goes on and says, my question is related to Acts when Paul is before the council and says, again, for the Sadducees say there's no resurrection or angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So what's up with that? You know, is how do we read that verse in light of what, you know, I had said? Now, here's my response to the questioner. There's actually controversy and ambiguity about the meaning of Acts 23:8. Sadducees could, of course, read the Old Testament, which has lots of angels in it. The issue is whether to have a Jewish sect, the Sadducees, denying parts of their Old Testament, or whether the phrase means something different. Note that angel is singular in the verse and in the statement. And then I say, I think that the latter is what's going on, that we have to, there's something specific about an angel that is what the Sadducees deny. In other words, the Sadducees aren't going to be denying that there are angels in their Old Testament. They can obviously read that. To illustrate the level of disagreement and to point out what I think is the answer, here's what Darrell Box says, and I quote from Box's commentary. Here's what, and I'll do that right now. So in Box's Acts commentary, he gives a summary of what the possible positions are as far as what's going on in Acts 23:8. He says, no extra-biblical text speaks of such a complete denial of angels and spirits by the Sadducees. So no Second Temple text is going to say that they just deny everything, you know, all belief in angels. In fact, the Pentateuch, which the Sadducees held as authoritative, affirms the existence of such beings. Okay, so it's a very obvious issue there. And again, I certainly agree with Bach. I mean, Sadducees did hold the Pentateuch to be authoritative and has lots of angels in it. So Bach says, there are six possible explanations for Luke's claim or the meaning of Acts 23:8. Number one, it's possible that the Sadducees rejected angels and spirits altogether, he says. The view sometimes includes specific angels, but again, because of what the Pentateuch says, this is probably the least likely answer. Second, the Sadducees could have rejected excessive speculation about angels and spirits. That's a possible way to take Acts 23:8. Third, the Sadducees could be rejecting the idea that the righteous dead came back in the form of spirits between death and resurrection. Now, this view argues that angel and spirit would mean the same thing in verses 8 and 9 of Acts 23. Okay, so there's an assumption there, but you know, it's one of the possibilities. But Luke says neither nor between verses 8 and 9, so he appears to be contrasting the two verses. And so this probably isn't the answer. Number four, the Sadducees could be denying that the resurrection included coming back in the form of an angel or a spirit. Now, again, the problem with this is that the Pharisees likewise would not have really been open to that sort of idea. A resurrection within history before the ultimate, you know, end of days and the great resurrection, which again is what Paul's argument seems to require. Now, I think there's something in this fourth possibility that Bach lists, this idea that the Sadducees are denying resurrection included coming back in the form of an angel. I think there's something to that. I actually think that this is what the Sadducees are denying, but I don't really like the way some scholars articulate it. So usually the objection to this one is, you know, as I mentioned, well, you can't really have a sort of a resurrection in the form of an angel before the ultimate resurrection, you know, the end of days. Well, I understand that, but we don't have to marry the idea of angelification, okay, a transformation of the dead person into an angel or divine spirit. We don't have to marry that idea to the ultimate resurrection or a competing resurrection. That really isn't the point. Angelification, this idea that when you died, if you were righteous, if you were a believer, when you died, you would be glorified, that you would be made like the angels, you know, in the presence of God. And then God could say, you know, direct you to come back to the realm of the embodied living or not, that whole sort of thing. That idea, angelification, was very common in the Second Temple period. It was held by several Jewish sects, including the sect at Qumran. So depending on how you define this idea, again, this could also be a New Testament idea, or again, if we define it in terms of glorification, to be made like angels. I actually think that this is what the Sadducees were denying. So in Acts 23:8, the Sadducees say there's no resurrection nor angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. I think the point is that the Sadducees say that there's no like alternative resurrection where you come back as an angel or some spirit being. I think that's specifically what they're denying. They're not denying that there are angels. Okay, because again, they can read their Old Testament, they can read the Pentateuch, and they considered it inspired. So I actually think this is the best way to parse what's going on in Acts 23:8. I'll give you two other possibilities Bach lists. Some scholars would say the Sadducees are rejecting the idea that an angel or spirit could speak through a human being. Again, and lastly, number six, some think that what Luke is describing here is the rejection of a full hierarchy of angels, you know, like a very specific levels of hierarchical relationships. There was a lot of speculation on that in the Second Temple period. So you know, this view would say, well, the Sadducees just aren't buying any of that hierarchical stuff. Again, those are six views. I think the fourth one, that the Sadducees are denying, you know, some sort of glorification as an angel or divine spirit, I think that's what they're denying because, like I just said a few minutes ago, it's very obvious that there are angels in the Old Testament, in the Pentateuch, in the Torah, and the Sadducees held that as sacred. So I don't think that they're denying the existence of angels in total. Let's go back to Acts 23. The rest of what's going on here, you know, Paul, in verse 11 again, the Lord comes and appears to him and says, take courage. You testified about me here. You're going to also testify in Rome. The rest of the story in Acts 23 anyway is about a plot that's uncovered, where Paul's nephew, again, hears about an impending ambush of Paul and goes and tells Paul. Paul says, hey, take this kid to the tribune and make sure he knows. And then, of course, the guards, a huge guard, 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen in verse 23 are put around Paul when Paul makes a journey out of the jail to a different location to be heard by different authorities. So that's the rest of Acts 23. We don't really need to worry, really focus on anything in there. It's just the story of that foiled assassination attempt. We get into Acts 24. Let's just jump in here to the first verse because there are a couple things in here I think are interesting. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one of whom was Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, again, Felix is the governing authority here that you know, Paul is standing before. Tertullus says, reforms are being made for this nation. You're such a great guy, Felix. In every way and everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. So he kisses up to Felix to begin. Verse 5, we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also join in the charge, affirming that all these things were so. So they pull out, Tertullus is a Roman guy, Roman name. So they pull out, you know, a quote-unquote secular figure because they don't want Felix to conclude that this is just a religious matter, even though it is. And he starts off and says, oh, this is just a bad guy. And the Jews join in and say, yeah, you know, what that Roman guy said, you know, that's true. You know, you know, this guy's a plague. He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So the government nodded to Paul, and Paul again makes his defense. Now, I want, before we go any further, we're stopping here in verse 10. There are a couple of things that are very easy to skip over that are actually fairly important. And they're especially important if you're interested in, you know, one of them is anyway, if you're interested in what I call paleobabble. That is sort of, you know, some of the weird stuff people believe about the ancient world that I blog about. In many cases, it often is related to Jesus or the New Testament. So both of these have some importance to that, but one of them in particular I think you'll find fascinating. But let's hit both of them. They're both in Acts 24, verse 5. So here's the verse again. We have found this man a plague, in other words, a pest or a pestilence, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world. He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. First thing to observe is the word sect. Now, in the Greek text, this is the noun hieresis. So Tertullus, this Roman guy, calls Christianity a hieresis, a sect, which should mean, and would in this context mean, something like a school, like, you know, you've heard of the school of Plato or something like that. People who follow a particular teacher, or could refer to a school or a party, again, or a sect, okay, within Judaism. Now, this term is used of the Sadducees. In Acts 5:17, we read, the high priest rose up, and all who were with him, that is the party, the hieresis of the Sadducees, were filled with jealousy. It's also used of the Pharisees in Acts 15:5. We read, but some believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees, the hieresis of the Pharisees, rose up and said, it's necessary to circumcise the Gentiles in order to keep and to order them to keep the law of Moses. So it's sort of a neutral term. It just refers to a sect within the religion. But you can obviously tell hieresis sounds a little bit like heretic. And this is, in a derivational way, where our word heretic comes from. But really, it's a neutral term that means a sect or a group, you know, within, you know, a larger picture, a bigger picture. Now, Josephus uses the term of the Essenes. He uses it of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, just like the New Testament does. Paul himself, in verse 14, when he's allowed to defend himself, so let's just jump back in here. Paul says, after the governor nods to him, knowing that for many years you've been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring against me. But I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, there's hieresis, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, so on and so forth. So Paul says, yeah, you know, he says, my enemies here call the way, in other words, those of us who accept Jesus as Messiah, you know, followers of Jesus, who were known as the way, we've seen that before in Acts, they call the way a sect, a hieresis. Now, the wording is interesting because Paul isn't saying we are a sect. We're not a hieresis. We're not quote-unquote heretics here. But he's saying that's what other people say about us, about the way. So when the term is used by adversaries, it does take on sort of a negative, pejorative meaning to it. Acts 28:22 is an instance of this where the word occurs again. We desire to hear from you what your views are, for with regard to this sect, this hieresis, we know that everywhere it is spoken against. Again, these are more officials that Paul is going to testify before at the end of the book of Acts. So when it's used by one of your opponents, you know, it can be used to demonize a group. So the fact that it occurs in Paul's mouth doesn't mean that he's accepting the fact that, hey, yeah, you know, we're a bunch of heretics here and too bad for them. That's not what he's saying. He's alluding to the fact that his enemies use the term of Christians, you know, the original Christians this way. Now, the adjective form hieretikos is found once in the New Testament, Titus 3:10, a man that is factious or divisive. The King James actually has heretic. A man that is a heretic after the first and second admonition reject. Has to do with church discipline there, but basically someone who's factious. And we can see how that sort of works with school or party or sect. But hieretikos is where we get in English our word heretic. So here's the question. Here's why I bring it up. It's not just a point of curiosity. There are many people out there who want to defend especially Gnostic understandings of Jesus. They want to make this argument. They want to say things like, look, this whole concept of heresy, you know, and the Gnostics are always branded as heretics, and boo-hoo, that's just so unfair. This whole concept of heresy is late. Okay, it's not in the New Testament. It's something that develops later in the after the first few centuries of Christian history, so that the Christians that got approved by the Roman Empire, you know, by Constantine and later Theodosian, that was when the whole idea of what is orthodox arose, so that you could look at somebody else and call them a heretic. And so their argument is that prior to, you know, the 300s or so, Gnostics would not have been looked upon as heretics. They would have just been looked upon as sort of like the loyal opposition, just another opinion here. Nobody's judging them. Their views are just as much in the mainstream as these other views that you could get in the New Testament with Pauline Christianity and whatnot. It was all sort of this level playing field. But then when politics got involved, okay, and one particular version became approved by the Roman Empire, and then you started to have these councils like Nicaea, it was only then that alternative understandings of Jesus became heretical. This whole concept of orthodoxy and heresy didn't even exist until the 300s or 400s. Okay, that's bunk. And it's demonstrably the case, because not only do you have, you know, what we've just looked at, this term hieresis in the New Testament, you also remember I mentioned that it was in Josephus. Okay, Josephus is Second Temple material. It's also in other texts, the idea that the Hebrew word is min, you know, to be a kind of Jew. You know, there were different sects. Minim is the plural. There are different sects or parties or divisions or kinds of Judaism. There wasn't just one kind of Judaism. There were a number. And you can read in Second Temple texts that these terms, whether it's hieresis in Greek or min, again in Hebrew, they do get used pejoratively, directed at a set of ideas and people who hold a set of ideas as being out of the mainstream. That is not a late idea. Okay, it's an idea that's around even before we have a New Testament. So that when we get to the New Testament, you see it's the Sadducees. This is what Paul says. They're the ones that call us a sect. Okay, and it's used pejoratively because the Sadducees and Pharisees are looking at Paul saying, "You're the nutcase, dude." And they're using the term again to delegitimize Paul. Now, what's going to happen with the New Testament writers, you know, outside of this trial scene, they're going to talk about divisions. They're going to talk about false teaching. Okay, they're going to talk about this danger. And so what becomes factious or divisive or quote-unquote heretical in the New Testament writings is going to be these alternative views of Jesus. If you don't embrace Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus is God come in the flesh, and that, those sorts of things, you are not what we're teaching. You become, again, a sect. You become an offshoot. You become an aberration of what we're saying. So these terms were used to evaluate religious views and religious ideas long before, you know, Emperor Constantine showed up to quote-unquote legitimize what we would think of as orthodoxy. Because Gnostics want to argue this all the time. Like the Gnostic views of, you know, what we would call heterodox or non-orthodox views of Christianity, what we would give that label to today, they would say, oh, no. Back then, they were all legit. They were all on the same footing. They were all, you know, just kind of, you know, had equal status. That is not the case. Okay, you cannot exclude the New Testament and exclude the Second Temple period when you have that discussion. And that's what defenders of revisionist Jesuses, and one of those is the Gnostic Jesus, they try to do this perpetually. So again, I thought this was a good sort of spring off point, or, you know, jumping off point to get into that a little bit. Now let's go back to Acts 24:5, the second part of the phrase, sect of the Nazarenes. The second word there that's important is Nazarenes. Not catch the way I pronounce this, Nazorios. Notice there's a long O there, Nazorios. in Acts 2:22, we see the phrase again, men of Israel, this is Peter's sermon, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, and the Greek there is Nazorios, a man attested to you by God, a mighty work, so on and so forth. Now, Jesus is elsewhere called a Nazarenos. Notice there's no long O there. Nazarenos, Luke 4:34, Luke 24:19. Again, why do we have these two terms? Do they mean the same thing? Do they both just refer to somebody from Nazareth? Well, Nazorios occurs this place in Acts. It occurs a few other places where it's used to label a Christian sect, as opposed to Nazarenos, which seems to be an indication of the place. And so why am I bringing this up? Well, here's the issue. Scholars have long disputed whether both of these terms, Nazorios and Nazarenos, whether they speak of the same thing or not. And the reason it's important was because there are some scholars, and again, if you've read sort of the Paleo-Babel literature, again, this revisionist Jesus stuff, you're going to run into authors that say, look, Nazorios, the one with the long O, cannot be reconciled with Nazarenos. In other words, Nazorenos does not mean somebody from Nazareth. It means something else. And that something else is a pre-Christian sect. So what they're claiming, and again, the conspiratorial Jesus stuff will claim this, was that Jesus was actually a member of a religious sect himself prior to what we learn about and what they would say is fabricated about Jesus in the New Testament. Now, this particular Christian sect are the Mandeans. And again, there are these long arguments about how this different vowel, the different spelling, they can't be recognized, and one indicates a specific religious sect that has nothing to do with what we think of as biblical Christianity. So it turns out to them, they argue, that Jesus wasn't even a Christian. Jesus was some other religious sect, the Mandeans. The Mandeans are the ones that refer to themselves as Nazorios in other texts. Church historians, what major religions, what all the big players in Christianity think about Jesus isn't true. He actually had different beliefs than they did, because the Mandean theology is not what you people, you Christians running around, saying is orthodoxy. The Mandeans wouldn't have agreed with that, and Jesus was one of them. Now, this is a long, really technical discussion. I mean, I think you can tell it already. We're getting into vowel sounds and word formation and whatnot. I want to read you something, and then I'm going to allude to something that I've given to Trey to post with this episode on the website. So if you're into, again, revisionist Jesus stuff, or maybe you've come across this in some YouTube video or whatever, you're going to have a resource here. But let me read first from a commentator, C.K. Barrett, who's he's deceased now, but a very revered Greek scholar, said this in his Acts commentary. Christian preaching begins with the name of Jesus. He is first identified as Ha Nazorios. This is best explained as of or from the place called Nazareth. Other interpretations, however, have been given based on the observations that it's not easy to see how the O, the Omega, in Nazorios could be derived from the ah, the alpha, in the corresponding syllable of Nazareth, and that Nazoraya is one of the names applied to the Mandeans. Let me repeat that, Nazoraya. This name has been divided from Hebrew Nazar to guard or observe, that is the Mandean name, and given the meaning of the observance, that is, those who observe with particular care rites of baptism and purification and so on. These other people argue that the name may have been given to Jesus and his followers as the observance. It may have arisen through their connection with John the Baptist and his disciples. And here's the way Barrett ultimately ends his little discussion. The name, however, was discussed at great length by H. Shader in something we now call the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. And his conclusion is to be accepted, end of quote. So Barrett says, look, this is a technical issue. If you want to know what the truth really is, go to this article in Theological Dictionary of the New Testament by Shader, and that guy has it right. Well, lo and behold, I have that article. And I just took it from TDNT, Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. And I have given that to Trey. Trey will put a link to that next to this episode. And the short answer, and again, it's a long article, and it is technical. You really need to have Greek and Hebrew at least first year to really understand Shader's article. But the short version is this. The long O can be explained, and the two terms can be reconciled. Here's the way Shader ends his article. We may confidently say that Nazoraios, like Nazarenos, is the Greek form of the Aramaic Nasraya, derived from Nazrat, or Nazareth. They both point to being from Nazareth. It's that neither of them points to some obscure sect, pre-Christian sect. And so Jesus didn't come from some religious sect that would have disagreed with what we have in the New Testament. That's the bottom line. So if you want to wade into that article, if you have a little Greek and Hebrew, that is the ammunition to basically blow to bits this idea that you may have heard again on a YouTube video or read in some book, trying to, again, prop up Jesus as not even being a Christian, as bizarre as that sounds. So back to Acts 24, again, that was a long rabbit trail, but again, I think both of those things, the meaning of sect, what the whole discussion of when was heresy and orthodoxy actually even thought about, I think that's important. And then this whole issue about Jesus being from some pre-Christian sect, that's also important. So that was verse 5. And so Paul continues in his defense. He's accused of this. He says, look, you know, none of this stuff is true. I was in the temple, verse 17, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation, present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple. I wasn't making trouble without any crowd or tumult, but some Jews from Asia, and they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation, should they have anything against me. Or else these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found in me when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing, that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day. And we've read that in Acts 22 and Acts 23. So Paul just relates what happened. And then we read in verse 22, Acts 24, but Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case. And he gave orders to the centurion that he should keep in custody, you know, keep Paul in custody, but give him some liberty, and that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. So Felix sees right through this ruse. And that chapter of Acts ends with Felix and his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. They send for Paul, you know, off and on, talk to him. And, you know, Paul, of course, witnesses to him. But ultimately, Felix leaves Paul in prison. And then Acts 25, you know, comes along. And so Acts 25, the whole chapter, is really a repetition where Paul, you know, again, brings his case before somebody else, before Festus, you know, and then Agrippa and Bernice at Caesarea. So it's just two more trials. And so I'm not even going to stop on anything in Acts 25, but I want to get to some things in Acts 26 here. So let's jump into Acts 26 when Paul has testified before King Agrippa, or he's in the process of doing so. So we read in verse 1, Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. Then Paul stretched out his hand and made his defense. I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, I am going to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews, especially because you're familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. And then he goes in again to his testimony and talk a little bit about his background, who he is. He says in verse 9, I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. I did so in Jerusalem. You know, I was a terrible guy. Verse 12, I went to Damascus on the authority and commission of the chief priests, again, to persecute, you know, people who followed the way. Then Paul gets into his testimony of the Damascus Road. And then we read in verse 15, verses 15 through 18, part of Paul's testimony, we read this. Paul gets knocked off his horse. In verse 15, we read, and I said, this is Paul speaking, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But rise and stand upon your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant and a witness to the things in which you have seen me, and to those in which I will appear to you. Verse 17, delivering you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. That's the end of verse 18. So the thing I want to zero in on here is really verse 18, where Jesus tells Paul that part of what he's going to be doing is to open their eyes. Again, I'm going to deliver you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I'm sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God. Now, I bring this up because the language here is a little bit like what we find in 2 Corinthians 4:4. Now, I don't know if I've brought this verse up before or not. There's one or two places I could have, but 2 Corinthians 4:4, let's just start in verse 1 and you'll get the flavor of what Paul's writing here to the Corinthians, and you'll see, again, how the language is similar. Paul says to the Corinthians, "Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing." Now here's verse 4. "In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." Okay, so you see several words there. Let me go back and read verse 18, Acts 26:18. "To open their eyes that they may turn from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God." Now the question is in 2 Corinthians 4:4. When you read the phrase, "the God of this world," okay, "has blinded the minds of unbelievers," everyone assumes that that's Satan. There's actually a case that could be made that the one who's blinding the minds of the unbelievers is God. And the reason that case can be made, or has been made, that's probably a better way to say it, has been made, is because of what we read in Isaiah 6. So we're going all over the place here. Acts 26:18, then 2 Corinthians 4:4. Now we're in Isaiah 6. Listen to what Isaiah 6 says in verse 4. This is, you know, the throne room vision with the seraphim and all that stuff. Verse 4 says, let's go to verse 8. "I heard the voice of the Lord saying," this is Isaiah now, "whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Okay, speaking to Isaiah, let me correct myself. "I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, who will go for us?" Isaiah hears that, but of course, the question, God is seated on the throne in the midst of, you know, his council room, his throne room. The question is sort of put out there, and the whole wording there, "for us," again, this is one of those instances, kind of like Genesis 1:26, when God is speaking to the members of the heavenly hosts, speaking to the audience. "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" Well, Isaiah hears that, so it's sort of meant for him too. "Then I said," continuing in verse 8, you know, Isaiah's speaking now, here I am, send me. "And he said, go and say this to the people." So this is Isaiah's commission. "Say this to the people. Keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." So God's saying, okay, Isaiah, I'm going to send you. Here's your job. Tell the people, keep on hearing, but don't understand. Keep on seeing, but don't perceive anything. And then God says, make the heart of this people dull. Make their ears heavy. Make their eyes blind. So again, in this chapter, in Isaiah 6, God is the one, as a punishment, you know, who's sort of making this happen. Well, some scholars have taken that and gone back to 2 Corinthians 4:4 and said, well, the God of this world who's blinded the minds of the unbelievers, that might be God, okay? Now, why do I bring all this up? Is this some crazy rabbit trail? I bring it up because Acts 26:18, I think, clarifies this issue. Let me read it one more time, okay? Jesus said to Paul, I'm going to deliver you from the people and from the Gentiles, your people and the Gentiles, Jews and Gentiles. I'm going to deliver you. And the Gentiles are the ones I'm sending you to. Why? To open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light. And here's the key phrase, and from the power of Satan to God. Now, I would suggest that this language here that Jesus is speaking to Paul is what Paul has in mind in 2 Corinthians 4:4. And that the God of this world in 2 Corinthians 4:4 is indeed Satan. Even though we have Isaiah 6, where God is the one blinding, you know, the unbeliever. Okay, it seems to me that Paul is drawing on this episode that, you know, is way back at his conversion. And he draws on that in 2 Corinthians 4, and he actually has Satan in mind when he uses the phrase God of this world, who has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So I think Acts 26:18 helps inform our reading of 2 Corinthians 4:4, which is why I bring it up. Now, lastly here, one more thing in Acts 26, and we'll wrap up. As we keep going, again, after Paul has said this, he says to Agrippa, "Therefore, O King Agrippa," verse 19, "I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but I declared first to those in Damascus, then in Jerusalem, throughout all the region of Judea, and also the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds in keeping with that repentance." So again, Paul continues with his testimony. And he says in verse 23, let's go back to verse 22. He says, "I stand here testifying, both to small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass." Here's verse 23. "That the Christ must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles." Now, this whole notion of proclaiming light to the Jew and to the Gentiles sort of, again, harkens back to what we just read in 17 and 18. Again, light, darkness, you know, turning from Satan to God, all that stuff. What Paul is essentially saying here in preaching is illumination for both Jews and Gentiles. In other words, when Paul starts talking about the light, bringing the light, he's not talking about what New Agers are talking about. He's not talking about personal enlightenment, like you're going to go contemplate your navel now, and you're going to get in touch with your feelings, you're going to discover yourself, all that sort of thing. No, he's talking about something very specific. He's talking about their eyes being opened so that they can see something very specific. And the very specific thing is the gospel. Jesus rises from the dead. Okay, the first to rise from the dead. Christ must suffer and then rise from the dead. It's the gospel. This salvation and this light is a revelation given to the Jews and the Gentiles that is very specific. Again, it's not this self-contemplation, Oprah gospel kind of stuff, which is why I bring it up. I mean, it echoes Isaiah 49:6, where we read, "It is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob," God, again, speaking to the individual who's called the servant. "You should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. And I will make you a light for the nations, and that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." Again, it's just this whole idea of bringing the Jews back into relationship with God and also bringing the nations back, which is a big theme in the book of Acts. So I wanted to throw that in because I've seen this verse and other verses, just trust me here, used in just the way I sort of made fun of. You know, Christianity is about bringing us light. You know, again, all this self-internalizing, self-reflection, self-discovery kind of thing. It's not. It's very specifically tied in this verse to the gospel and tied to the Old Testament program of God carving out his people, his family, which included the nations, even in the Old Testament, even back in Isaiah 49.
All right. Good deal, Mike. We appreciate it. A lot of good information in those four chapters. Mike, is there anything new you want to talk about with the funding of your new projects and updates for us?
Yeah. By the time people listen to this, which will be a couple of days, I will very likely have posted about some specific new projects that I will be able to use some of the funding that would have went to the bibliography. The bibliography is moving along quite a bit. Again, we got extra money because we left that open. So there are some other projects. Go to up to drmsh.com, go to the Naked Bible, and you'll see something about, here's what to look for, something about a 3-book series that I have that needs editorial help. So if you are in some way experienced as a copy editor, maybe a content, a line editor, that kind of thing, and you do freelancing or whatnot, I'd like to hear from you because that's essentially what I'm going to post. And it should be up there by the time that we have this episode live. But that is the next, again, very specific project that I have in mind to be able to pay someone to do. I won't say any more than that. Just go up to the post and read a little bit about what those books are and, you know, what the plan is for them. But glad you brought it up, Trey.
All right. Looking forward to that. All right, Mike. Well, next week we'll be doing our fourth Q&A, so be looking forward to that. And I really enjoy seeing where our listeners are from. So with your questions, if you would include where you're from, I'd appreciate it. I know we've got listeners from Denmark to New Zealand and then all over North America. So next week, Mike, we're going to be doing our fourth Q&A. So be looking forward to that. Well, with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to another episode of the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.